And hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
And Peter, when you were last here, we had the Al Gore documentary about climate change, and then in this episode, we found the solution.
A coincidence? I think not.
If only it were so simple. End credits. That's your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here Thursdays at 10 a.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the sci-fi disaster movie Geostorm. That will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to tackle some movie news from the past week, including The Snowman. And before this movie even opened, it was under attack, and the person doing the attacking was none other than Thomas Alfredson, the director. So what is he so mad about his own film for? And then it's been almost 20 years since Tim Burton cast Nicolas Cage as Superman in Superman Lives. That was supposed to be a live-action movie, but could it be an animated movie? Well, it almost happened, and then we'll talk about that. But first of all, David Fincher, that's a name that is both respected and beloved by movie fans, a director of a lot of great movies like Seven, Fight Club, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Gone Girl. It goes on and on and on. He had some thoughts about the current state of movies, and it kind of covered a whole whack of things, like from Netflix, because he just released a new series that he produced and directed several episodes of, Mindhunters. That's actually his second Netflix series. He directed and produced the first couple of episodes of House of Cards, too, so he was like an early adopter to Netflix.
He's still working on House of Cards, too. Isn't he the creator?
I think he gets some kind of co-creator credit, I think, but he's also an executive producer. But I mean, I don't think he's directed any of the recent episodes. I think he directed the pilot in the second episode, and that was that.
Well, that explains a lot about the show, though.
And then he also talked about how he almost was in the running for directing Star Wars The Force Awakens, and talked about Marvel movies, and you know, he covered a whole wide range of things. But the thing I found interesting was that, I guess because he was an early adopter of Netflix, he kind of wasn't of the doom and gloom, like this we're at the end of cinema as we know it kind of thing. You know, he was actually rather optimistic, which is interesting given his, you know, where he sort of exists in movie making sort of these mid-budget think pieces and dramas and detective stories. You know, you'd think that he would probably be more pessimistic about the state of movies, but he wasn't, actually.
Yeah, although he referred to some of the current kind of booming genres in not a great way. Mm-hmm. Spandex summer, superhero tentpole, moderately budgeted sequel.
Yeah.
Affliction Oscar bait. I like that because Oscar bait is just its own genre now.
Sure.
But he was being as optimistic as a director of his nature could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what he's talking about with regards to movies, I think that's why he is working more so on TV, specifically Netflix. He has the current show coming. Do you remember its name?
You mean Mindhunters?
Yeah, Mindhunters.
Yeah, that's you can stream that right now.
Actually. Okay, apparently it's wonderful. So I'm glad that he's sticking to TV and he's not kind of... It'd be okay if he was trying to kind of evolve into the current nature of directors and like blockbuster films, but he has more control on TV, so I am glad that he's working with Netflix currently.
Yeah. Him and Steven Soderbergh, too, they kind of came out of the same class almost. Or, you know, kind of broke at the same time, maybe a couple of years apart, but that's where Steven Soderbergh's passion has been lately. And but the thing I'll give Fincher credit for, he doesn't make a big deal like, well, I'm retiring because I can't handle movie making anymore. That wasn't an actual Steven Soderbergh impression, but he uses a lot of the, you know, Oscar bait and spandex and, you know, sequels and things, and all that's true.
But he's trying to be optimistic.
Right, he's trying to be optimistic. Oscar bait has always been there, of course.
Yeah.
You know, studios would, of course, try to leverage, you know, actors and directors and resources to try and win, you know, Oscars. Perhaps a bit more prestigious in the past than they are in recent years. But when you hear, you know, a lot of directors talk, you know, you look at what happened at Cannes this year where the Netflix logo comes up before a movie and it's booed. And,
I know.
It's weird. Yeah, you know, where people consider the purity of cinema only existing in a theater, in a movie theater. You know, it's kind of the way TV was treated 30, 40 years ago, where it was kind of seen as second class arts, I guess. And I think streaming gets treated that same way. So I still think it was refreshing to hear Fincher, you know, as an early adopter of that, take a tone that, like, no, this is where
too.
We're going.
I thought he'd be like the exact opposite of that. Like, I thought he would be despising like the Marvel films and all the reboots and remakes and things like that. But
yeah, and this, the thing about the Star Wars is he didn't say like we should never make Star Wars movie or anything like that. It was, you know, he talked about how he had a meeting with Kathleen Kennedy, who's the head of Lucasfilm and hence the head of Star Wars, that. It just wasn't for him. That the headaches and, you know, I think that his exact quote was, maybe not exact, but off the top of my head, it was something to the effect of, you know, you have to bring a lot of energy and a lot of passion to it. And you have to sort of be all in other words. And, you know, if you're not all in, then you're in for 2 years of, you know, 7 day weeks, 14 hour days of nonstop headaches as you're trying to balance studio demands and fan demands and your own demands. As an artist,
he wouldn't be doing what he wants to do.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be, you know, that's a particular class of people, which is maybe why you've seen so much trouble with directors on Star Wars projects.
People were just mad at him too, just because he was trying to change a bit with The Gone Girl, just because it was based more so off a book than I think his other movies. But I thought if that was like a sign of his progression, I thought that was totally okay. I loved Gone Girl. I thought it was great. And if he's going to adapt what current films are doing more so, then that was the right way to do it, I think. So
I think some of his movies are a bit more, I want to say, commercial than others. Something like Zodiac it doesn't feel particularly commercial.
No,
because
not at all.
It's, you know, there's no chase sequences and there's no, you know, even the actual killing scenes aren't particularly gory or visceral.
No.
You know, it's a very procedural film, but versus something like Gone Girl, which had, you know, the Ben Affleck Renaissance kind of sheen on it. It was part of his comeback. Plus, it was based on a very popular book as well, Gillian Flynn's book. And then something like Curious Case of Benjamin Button 2, which is very glamorous and very Hollywood and with two big stars in the form of Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett. Although Brad Pitt is someone who is kind of a fellow traveler for David Fincher, someone who he collaborates with regularly, even
though he's fantastic.
Something like Fight Club, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, in Fight Club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You forget he's in Fight Club because he's not really there. Spoiler alert, Fight Club. But yeah, it's the other thing about the Marvel stuff, which is
I was surprised he wasn't angry about that either. He was actually saying some decently positive things towards it.
Right. It's I think
it's fun for different people.
He realizes
that it's fun for certain people, so you can't be against that, right?
Right. It's different strokes. I think what people feel though is that the one form, which is the Marvel form and the Star Wars form, and to a certain extent DC and all these other things, is that you're being asked to come into a thing where, you know, as a director, you used to be the last word, at least in their own minds. I mean, there's always been studio interference, but the director would be the tip of the sword on these things in terms of making decisions about story and about character and about direction. And what the Marvel and the Star Wars method seems to represent is you're coming into to execute a particular vision, and whether that's like a producer's vision or like these writing teams that are gathered, it's very hard for a director to be able to find a way to put his or her own stamp while still working within the confines.
Whereas he'd have full control over other films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's, again, he was very pragmatic about that. And I think where he comes from versus where a lot of other directors come from, which is which is, you know, no, this is stupid. This is not how you make movies. The director has a vision, executes, and it's up to him or her, and they're the last word. And I think, by and large, the feeling is that's the way it's going. And I think David Fincher is saying, well, there's still opportunities. It's the system's kind of imperfect. And I think he says something to that about, like, the studios. Like, the studios are just trying to do what they can inside sort of a very specific mandate, because studio people answer to people too, and it's usually people at the top of big media mm-hmm. conglomerates who see everything as an opportunity to make money. And if you're not using an opportunity to make money, then why are you doing anything? Which is, you know, why all these companies that own, you know, news outlets as well, why that they're so focused on making sure news outlets turn a profit as well. It's a much bigger dilemma than Fincher.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but at the same time, he was hesitant and he didn't do that. But apparently, he's going to be in the upcoming World War Z 2. He's going to be the director for that. Apparently, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was a rumor, but he was talking about it.
Yeah, what I read is that it was pretty confirmed. So,
yeah, like he was talking about, like, we're working on a story to make sure we're not just doing a sequel because. You know, for the sake of doing a sequel.
Yeah, but it wasn't a part of a broad universe. So I think he will have more control over this than he would any Disney film.
Right. And the original movie was a huge departure from the book, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
which is what he's more used to. Fight Club was way less than the book than Gone Girl was.
Yeah. I think you're right. And yeah, the thing I focus on about World War Z, though, is that... you know, it seemed like a typical Hollywood example of this. We have a brand name, we have people who love this book, and we're just going to throw Brad Pitt in it. We're going to throw people love zombies. So, but we're going to, instead of going R, we have to make it PG-13 so we can get as many people in possible. And the only thing that saved that movie, oddly enough, was the months of production difficulties that forced them to have to go back and reshoot the third act.
I was very glad of that. Yeah, because the third act wasn't spectacular. So if it was a remake, then
yeah,
they needed to do that. I didn't hate World War Z. I'm excited for the sequel if it's being directed by him.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
He loves Brad Pitt, so
yeah, they're a good team.
He's gonna be focusing on it. He's gonna be working hard.
And you're right. You know, it's a world that's been established now. It's kind of free of the expectations of the book. So you know, there's gonna be a lot of sort of wide open, sort of a wide open place for him to sort of engage in, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'll be interested to see it. And
100%.
But yeah,
hopefully you can bump it up to 14 plus though, or even 18 plus.
Well, I mean, he does work with R ratings.
He's
predominantly
used to it. That's
so,
why. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, that would be nice. I'll admit, The Walking Dead is not a PG-13 show. Anyway,
I wouldn't watch it if it was a PG-13.
No. Speaking of director trouble, Thomas Alfredson, he directed the original Swedish Let the Right One In and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, starring Gary Oldman. And he directed this new film that's out this week called The Snowman. And quite the departure from how typical studio promotion goes. He was on Norwegian TV talking about how they kind of jumped into this project. Now, it was apparently suddenly greenlit, so they jumped right in, started filming right away. They did not complete 10 to 15% of the script, he said, and I did the actual math. So if it was a 90-page script, that's about 9 to 14 pages they didn't shoot.
Oh, that is a lot of pages.
So, yeah, so when they got to the editing room, he said it was like putting together a jigsaw puzzle with pieces missing. And he said this 3 days before the release of the film.
Yeah, and I put a quote, he also said discovered that a lot was missing. So he repeated missing pieces multiple times. Why would you say that before the film comes out?
I don't know.
If you already know that it's not great, hopefully you still kind of are hoping you're going to get some money from it, so... shush until it's released. That's what I would do if I was him.
Maybe he thought he was safe on Norwegian TV.
I guess, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, this is... This I almost want to see this, and somebody actually, this was actually a headline I read somewhere that the snowman is so bad I want to see it now.
It does seem like the fun kind of bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
BuzzFeed actually had an article, 11 ridiculous things that happened in the snowman. And one of them was, someone talks about a visit to a pregnancy doctor. That's a quote, the quote-unquote pregnancy doctor. The main character, Harry, who's played by Michael Fassbender, Harry proves himself to be Scandinavia's worst legendary detective. And this is my favorite. The snowmen are just too adorable to be scary.
Oh, well, there you go. Now I really want to see it.
But yeah, this is a complete paradox, because you have Alfredson, who's the most people may not know by name, or probably haven't even seen his movies, but I mean, he comes with a very strong reputation.
We'll take your Taylor Soldiers by, yeah.
And this is based on, again, on a best-selling book by Joe Nesbo. And then this cast, Michael Fassbender, Rebecca Ferguson, Charlotte Gainsbourg, J.K. Simmons. Yeah.
J.K. Simmons.
Yeah,
right.
Val Kilmer's in it. Toby Jones is in it. This is a cast to die for. And and it sounds like they were kind of shooting it on the fly.
It's kind of like The Dark Tower. It was it was way more expected to be a critically acclaimed type of film, whereas it just didn't end up like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do find it curious. I think there's probably more to this story, but you know, this almost sounds like one of those stories you do hear about years later in terms of, you know, where things went wrong on a movie. Mm-hmm. It's just the unusualness of it is that before the release of the film, you have the director coming out saying, basically, it's not my fault, or it's not entirely my fault. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder what his motives are, because you're right. You know, you, most of the time you see these movies and they start, the reviews start coming out and the reviews are not good. And usually the initial reaction is from actors and directors is like, well, critics don't get it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think actors have to, at least when they're doing like interviews.
Sure. But that's the thing. It's critics don't get it. We're going to wait. This is for the audience. And we're going to see how the audience reacts.
But I think he knows that the critics, they do get it. And it's not well received.
And right. And there's more. Of course, there's been the ongoing debate this year about what responsibility Rotten Tomatoes has in terms of the terrible rating or the terrible returns.
Yeah. Whenever people talk about reviews, it's strictly whether it's fresh or not and Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
And there's a lot more sites. I make sure I check at least three: Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb. I don't use Metacritic. I do not support Metacritic because it's just run by one person, and they just pick the five reviewers or 10 or whatever the low number is that he agrees with. So it's just always his opinion on the film. But yeah, I think Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's great, and it is the one that usually gets the most amount of reviews. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the widest.
Well, it's the brand name.
Yeah, exactly. But I wish people would look at more. I wish critic reviews in newspapers or you know, online newspapers were still viewed more. And yeah, I wish things of that nature still existed. But I'm okay with Rotten Tomatoes.
But 9% this has. Snowman? As we record, yeah, 9%.
Ah.
It was higher, but it's been going
down.
I checked
2 nights ago. It was like at 20 or something.
Yeah, it's been going down. But it's at 9% now. And I did try to click through to find like a fresh review. And the best I could find is, it was four pages of rotten reviews. And then I get this one. It says, if you're tragic for the genre, The Snowman will scratch your itch. Which really doesn't say anything. It says, you know.
Well, it reveals that the snowmen are fun in it.
Yeah. But what it says is that, you know, if you're, you know, if you like these detective and murder mystery things, you will be satisfied. But if you're someone who is looking for, you know, a good movie with, you know, complex characters and compelling plot, you know, it says only the base will be satisfied by this. And
It's already like a lot of other films too. Like it kind of, I haven't seen it, but it just reminds me of the basic plot line of Fargo, right? It's a murder out in some place with a lot of snow. It's just all about that.
Yeah. It seems like the last couple of years we've been getting one of these movies kind of every October where it's like based on a best-selling book. It's a murder mystery. You got these great actors in it. This year it's The Snowman. Mm-hmm. 1 year it was Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. Last year it was The Girl on the Train, which is I did not think was very good at all.
Is that the one directed by Kenneth Branagh?
I don't know. I don't think it would. I think you're thinking of Murder on the Orient Express.
Yes, I am.
Which is another murder mystery in the snow coming out soon.
Yeah.
Although one based on a much older bestseller.
Yeah, it seems better.
Well, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Kenneth Branagh's mustache is on game in that movie, but at least from the trailers. But no, The Girl on the Train had Emily Blunt, and she was living vicariously through this couple she sees from the train every day, and the wife goes missing, and
the only
stuff
thing
happens.
That I'm okay with when it comes to that is I would prefer there being a bunch of movies based on books or graphic novels or comic books than there being repeated remakes of films that already exist or sequels not needed and things of that nature. Because at least if it's based on a book, it has never been seen in theaters, right? It hasn't been seen in a film. So at the pace we're going with so many films of the same nature existing and so many sequels and things, I think we might have to just accept that as something that will happen each year, something that will keep continuing.
So you'd rather watch a crappy murder mystery than another Batman movie, even if it's a good Batman movie?
Well, the Christopher Nolan Batman films were based on graphic novels. So if the Batman's based on like high-quality Batman graphic novel, or I'd probably still see that.
So in other words, you've just betrayed your intentions. Is you're betraying your principles. You still choose Batman over originality.
But originality is just so broad. It could be great, it could be bad. And nowadays it's way harder to do originality because Snowman is an example. Like, even though it's based on a book, it's still a totally different book than Fargo. It still has a similar plot to a lot of things that already exist.
True. But I did want to mention Batman because that does segue us nicely to our next topic. So Superman Lives, back in the 90s, back before Peter was born.
I was born in the 90s.
I'm just making fun. So back in the 90s, they were trying to reboot the Superman. This was after the Batman movies came. And this was actually around the same time they released Batman and Robin, oddly enough. But they wanted to adapt the death of Superman into the comic book story, the death of Superman into a movie. And it became a movie called Superman Lives. Tim Burton was hired to direct it. Nicolas Cage was hired to star as Batman. Superman, and that was considered something of a controversy because Nicolas Cage, even 20 years ago, did not have the Superman physique.
I guess there's that one photo of him in the costume.
Yeah,
that the article we read shows, and I actually think he looks pretty good.
Yeah,
I think he looks pretty great as Superman.
But you know that photo only came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, they should have shown that.
Because somebody, he's a director and he's also kind of like a critic and commentator, John Schnapp. If you watch the Collider video channel, he hosts a show called Heroes, which is about comic book movies and superhero movies. But he made a documentary called The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened? And it was sort of like in the midst of he was kind of gathering all this material that we started to see visions of this and the Nicolas Cage and the costume tests and a lot of the production art and a lot of what was going on behind the scenes. But I mean, I remember in the nascent days of the internet, sort of following along with this production and like people were aghast, like Tim Burton making a Superman movie, Nicolas Cage as Superman. This is the most ridiculous thing ever conceived.
Even back then when they were all very popular, like kind of at their peak,
right? Which is not oddly enough kind of the same stuff that they said about Batman when that production started, like Michael Keaton as Batman, this is ridiculous.
And Tim Burton,
the Beetlejuice guy, ridiculous.
I think Nicolas Cage could have done it.
I think he could too, but he might still do it because the point of this, we're not just talking this because, but at New York Comic Con, one of the guys who works on the DC animated universe movies, Michael Jelinek said that they actually wanted to do an animated version of the Tim Burton Superman Lives. And I thought, wow, that's such a great idea, because it's such a great time to do it because interest is high among fans. And they're kind of doing that already, because the latest one of these just came out, and it's Batman versus Two-Face. But it's done in the style of Batman 66, the old 60s TV show. And they have the voices of the late Adam West. I think this is like one of his last performances, maybe aside from a couple episodes of Family Guy that haven't been shown yet. And Burt Ward, who of course played Batman and Robin in the 60s show. And they have William Shatner as Two-Face. And William Shatner, of course, you know, from the same time period, you know, became famous in the same time period, because that was when Star Trek was on the air.
Yeah, 60s.
So, you know, it's this great kind of little throwback concept. And yeah, why not? Why not do a Tim Burton Superman Lives where it's all dark and Tim Burton-y and Nicholas? And he's Jelinek said Nicholas Cage would absolutely do the voice. Now, I'm not sure if that meant like he had a passing conversation maybe with Nicholas Cage or someone who knows Nicholas Cage, or if he's just assuming from Nicholas Cage's reputation.
No, I think that would be spectacular. But currently, like, a lot of the people who before the Disney Marvel films and the DCU films, a lot of the people who, like, love the comic books aren't loving that, especially the Marvel ones, because they're made more so for kids, right, and for families to go see. So a lot of the current animated DC Marvel TV shows and films are, like, doing critically quite well, and, like, true fans, like you, I'm assuming, like, seem to love them. So I hope they do this. I hope they make an animated TV show of the, or animated movie of this nature. And it's, am I wrong, it could be Kevin Smith who writes it? Or was that the intent for the original one?
Kevin Smith wrote the script. And you can probably find it on YouTube easily enough, where he talked about working with the producer, John Pierce, on the script and his kind of wacky demands for it. But Kevin Smith, this was like right after Mallrats.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was hired to write the script, to turn basically turn the Death of Superman comic book, which the storyline ran for like a year from death to resurrection, to turn all those comics into a two-hour movie. And he did that, and then they hired Tim Burton, and Tim Burton basically threw away Kevin Smith's script, even though a lot of people... I mean, I think this is kind of the beginning of that feud.
Yeah.
But, the Kevin Smith wrote the script, and I've read this script, and it's decent. It's not great, but it certainly does... it's certainly probably one of the best examples of somebody taking the genre seriously before, you know, we started getting into, you know, the turn of the century with X-Men and the first Spider-Man movie. Because that was kind of a rare that someone would take the source material seriously. And Kevin Smith did that. But then this out went his script when Tim Burton came on board, and then they could never find another writer who could turn a decent draft.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me.
And I think they literally shut the production offices the day before principal photography was supposed to start.
Oh, man. I think if it had happened, I would have liked it.
It would have been interesting.
Yeah, and when it came out, I would have been a kid.
Yeah.
So even if it was bad, I probably still would have
You probably
loved
would
it.
Have very fond feelings about
yeah,
it.
Fond yeah, fond feelings for it. So yeah, that's really too bad, because I love Nicolas Cage too. And I even liked him in, I think, Knowing, that film Knowing. So I think I probably would have loved this film. I probably would have loved this film.
If you liked Knowing, you will like Superman Lives, if it had happened. Alas, it did not. What is happening right now is they are making another Halloween movie. Jamie Lee Curtis and...
So like the original cast back.
Well, I think it's
her. Jamie Lee Curtis, yeah. The only
the original final
member.
Girl.
Yeah.
but,
I'm okay with that. I've always liked the Halloween films. I thought the Rob Zombie Halloween, I think he did two of them, right? Mm-hmm. I thought they were spectacular too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's a bit more acceptable because the original Halloween film and then the second one, they're all different. Like, they're all of kind of a different nature. So I'm totally okay with that.
I only mention it, first of all, to reveal that Peter loves the Rob Zombie Halloweens, but also to play this, our musical break, which is a cover of John Carpenter's Halloween theme, which has been redone by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And you may know those guys. They worked with David Finch a lot. They did Social Network and Gone Girl. And then also the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo remake that Finch did. This is really great, though, and because we got Halloween coming up on Tuesday, we'll just pause here and then come back with our review of Geostorm. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
That's why I'm calling.
Phone service just came back on.
Yeah, well, you're lucky to be alive.
I'm in those gas pipes?
I'm not so sure that was the cause.
What do you mean?
I don't follow.
It was abnormally hot before the pipes flew.
The satellite sensor should have recorded it, right? I've checked over a dozen times, but I can't get access to Dutch Boy's Hong Kong satellite. My access has been blocked.
Check your holoframe.
I don't understand. We both have clearance.
Exactly. And the only people that have authority to block it
are in the building you work in.
Wait. What do you mean?
If someone is covering up a system defect, there's potential for critical failure on a global scale.
If Dutch Boy has a catastrophic failure, it can create something
far worse than the very thing we're trying to prevent.
What we call a geostorm.
Oh, wait, slow down, Chang, all right? A what?
A geostorm. Simultaneous catastrophic weather events triggered all over the globe.
Once they pass the minimum threshold, the storms will start causing new storms, like a chain reaction, until they merge together.
It's gotta be a glitch.
Give you a call when I know some.
All right. Thanks.
I actually forgot that they actually explained what a geostorm was in that in the movie.
Oh yeah, they do.
I was prepared to like go on a rant about they don't even tell us what a geostorm is. Anyway, I'm glad we played that clip so that now we all know what a geostorm is.
Finally.
And that was a clip. Yeah, finally. That was a clip from Geostorm, which is the new film by Dean Devlin, and it stars Gerard Butler, Jim Sturgess, Abby Cornish, Andy Garcia, and Ed Harris. Gerard Butler and Jim Sturgess, believable as brothers, do you think?
I don't know, man. Is Gerard Butler British? Is he? They're very, very different voices and looked very, very different.
That's an interesting question. I was listening to the We Hate Movies episode about Olympus Has Fallen.
Yeah,
which is another guilty pleasure of mine. It is what it sells. It's Die Hard in the White House. But the We Hate Movies guys did it as an episode, and they said Gerard Butler is from Dublin, Oklahoma. So,
okay.
Which it sort of sums up
what the
accent.
Is.
Well, what the film is, but it sums up
the quality.
Yeah, there's a line in it where he says like, "Well, me and my brother were born in the UK, but we came to America." Which is why my accent's so messed up, because I'm the older brother, and Jim Sturgess has a perfectly serviceable American accent.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, they were very, very different. But they might have done that on purpose. So Jake, Gerald's character, was like objectively like the older brother style, like what
right.
all older brothers in films are like.
Yeah.
You know, the older brother who lost his job and, you know, his wife left him.
Yeah,
but he still has his single daughter to love him. You
he's
know,
a good
but
guy.
He's grumpy. Yeah.
He's gruff.
Yeah.
The younger brother, of course, is super accomplished, and
yeah.
he works in the White House. And
no, they didn't really seem like brothers, but unfortunately, also, their brotherhood was probably the only part of the film that I enjoyed. I guess I thought it was okay.
Wow, ringing endorsement. Yeah, it's I found it kind of problematic because anytime they had to like deal with each other, I had to suspend my disbelief that they weren't brothers, and I'm like, okay, they're talking one brother to another, I guess.
If I hadn't heard the brother thing like at the beginning, I might have just for the whole film thought they were like best friends or something
Yeah, they pushed the brother angle pretty hard up front, so just so it's stuck in your head that they're brothers, mm-hmm. and you're not thinking, why are they talking like they're so close? Because they're nothing alike. Okay, problem number two. Gerard Butler as a scientist?
Yeah, that was very unbelievable. No, he, you know, I believed he was a gladiator, and but this, no, it just wasn't his job. Even though it was like more the physical type, like, you know, like an astronaut. It's
right. Yeah, because astronauts have to be fit.
They got to be fit, right. And, but they got to know a ton about physics.
Yeah,
and he just wasn't a very believable genius. No offense to him.
It's not that I doubt his abilities, and I don't know how much of this is in the writing or how much of this is because they underestimate Butler perhaps as a performer.
I mean, think so.
But even how much they underestimate like what scientists do. But the plot is basically this guy, Jake Lawson, played by Gerard Butler, has invented the solution to global warming, which is this net of satellites that goes around the world and will, you know, sort of adjust the weather so that you don't get extreme weather events like huge hurricanes or huge droughts or anything like that. And so Butler, I guess, came up with this, you know, while sitting on the porch of his trailer, and save the world, and they, you know, it was a worldwide effort, and they constructed a huge space station with gravity, and they have these little holographic things that they can interface with the satellites with, and it's all great. And then
he changed the world, and he saved humanity.
He changed the world, and so this guy's pretty much Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Isaac Newton, and Leonardo da Vinci combined, and he lives in a trailer after being fired as the head of this project, which is this big scene at the beginning because he melts off to a center.
It just didn't work.
No, it didn't work at all. It just, there's, you know, there's no way that someone who invents the thing that saves the world then like goes and lives on the beach and in a ramshackle trailer building engines or whatever he was doing.
And why did he, what was the specific reason he, for so long, has been obsessed with saving the environment?
Yeah.
Like, why specifically him? Did something happen when he was a kid? Like, why is he so focused and obsessed with that?
And how did he come up with the idea?
Yeah, that mainly.
How does it work? Because, that's the big thing. I mean, I don't expect this I don't expect, like, Geostrom to come out with a technical manual explaining how this, in precise scientific
detail.
It's
not going to be like Martian, where it actually all can be explained, you know?
Well, exactly. But, you know, it shows, like, we have these satellites. They're in orbit. They're a network. And then they fix the weather. Okay, great. Can you go into detail? No, they're just breaking, and we need Gerard Butler to fix them.
Yeah, but one of the only things I did find kind of cool was seeing some future CGI footage, seeing what, it could look like this in, you know, 2 years, maybe. Visuals were the only thing you could possibly enjoy, and that was kind
well, that
of
was
fun.
I mean, that's the compelling part of this, and where it could have went somewhere. It's just the prescience of it, especially after this fall, which, I mean, obviously they couldn't have predicted when they set the release date, having like four or five huge hurricanes.
Well, there was
a
huge hurricane last year, though, too.
Well, I mean, there usually is, but, you know, not like four or five, not like a geostorm
and
kind of event.
I checked. They started filming it in 2014.
Okay.
So three years ago.
Yeah,
so,
there have been problems.
And the president thing, too, especially. Having a president is such a major focus.
Right.
With what's going on.
Not only that, but there's a question of whether or not the president is evil.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
And of course, did you notice that he's a Democrat? Did they make a point of saying
yes.
He's the Democratic
president?
That was
probably written in after, what happened.
Yeah. So it's, you know, there are kind of all these various elements in the works, and it kind of goes... It's
slow.
Well, it goes slow, and... They don't really capitalize on it at all, and it just becomes CGI disaster porn. And I think that's the problem I have with these movies now, is that it's so easy to destroy a city with using computer-generated effects.
I don't even think the CGI was of a high enough quality to justify the lack of plot for this one. Like, there was a lot of really cool shots, but...
Yeah. Well, the first like, geostorm event where they're in, like, the middle of the desert, and then they find snow, and they find this village where everybody was kind of, like, flash frozen. That was kind of eerie.
Mm-hmm. That was eerie.
And it didn't involve, like, a huge effects thing at all. They just walked to a village and find a bunch of frozen people who are kind of, like, frozen in the moment.
And made me feel the way I should feel when viewing something like that. It was the only part of the film where, like, part of me was kind of hoping, like, oh, you know, maybe there'll be some other good things.
Right. Maybe they, you know, this has kind of been undersold as, you know, a kind of disaster POS. But, a disaster literally and figuratively. The next sequence is like some sort of, I don't know, like some kind of eruption situation from underground. And that's not particularly explained, like what happened or how weather satellites were managed to like have create a volcanic event or something.
Yeah, they're able to do
but,
a lot.
But then that entire sequence is like buildings falling over and things exploding. And
the one shot of the buildings falling over, it looked exactly like dominoes. So then I thought that was kind of cool.
Although
a little fake too. They could have just put dominoes in front of a green screen and then CGI those dominoes. Who knows? But it was fun. That was fun to watch.
Well, it was a well executed sequence. But they immediately go for something like huge and over the top, and I don't know a lot about physics, but that felt pretty implausible to me.
And, yeah,
you know, you're already dealing with this implausible thing where it's like we used science magic to fix global climate change. You know, there's only so far you can go with this until you manage to not just suspend disbelief but sort of break disbelief in half. And I just feel like starting with 2012, which was released in 2009, mm-hmm. but it was also by Dean Devlin's former partner in filmmaking, Roland Emmerich, but there's that movie is just so deeply cynical, mm-hmm. because basically the entire world gets destroyed save for a bunch of rich bastards in John Cusack's family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just go on.
Well, I was just gonna say that's, you know, and to get from A to B, you have to, you know, live through these continuous sequences of people just dying, and there's absolutely no hope at all because this is the end of the world. And it wasn't quite that dire in this.
No, you knew that the world was gonna get saved.
Right.
Or did it?
Well, I think
some people haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay, you're right. Spoilers. but it just felt the exact same way because this comes down to a plot of like some kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when you're talking about a movie about extreme weather threatening the lives of everyone on Earth, do you really need the conspiracy element to it?
No, you
it
don't
doesn't add to. Anything. Except, you know, it makes you sad because at the center of this incredibly altruistic endeavor to save the planet, and then there's still a few a-holes who, you know, are out for themselves. And
yeah, and that wasn't necessary. It could have been all of us just kind of trying to save the world.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the environment is something that all of us humans have to deal with. So we didn't need really to have a human character as like a major enemy behind it all.
Right. I would like to think, and it, you know, my opinion on this is being tested every day, but if it gets to the point where you have 2 million people dying under extreme heat in Madrid in a single day, mm-hmm. which is one of the events that spurns the creation of the satellites, mm-hmm. I say at the beginning of the film, even the Scott Pruitts of the world and the Donald Trumps and the Koch brothers have to admit that's deeply messed up, and maybe we should do something about it because we're, you know, what's the next event that's going to kill millions of people?
Well, in rich people like that, even with their money, yeah, there's probably some, you know, devices or walls or security devices they can do that'll help them for the time being with the environment. But like way in the future, like they're, you know, their relatives descended from them that are probably trillionaires, or there's not going to be anything they can do. Money's not going to help them from the environment.
Yeah.
And I also just want to add, it's a lot like that Will Smith and Jaden Smith film, Not Pursuit of Happiness, the one that's
After Earth.
After Earth. It's a lot like that in the sense that even if you see the trailer and there is some cool CGI, at the end of the day, it's actually quite boring. I was quite bored throughout the whole film. A lot of it was just in the Senate, you know, just like an Independence Day. A lot of scenes just in there with the president talking. And a lot just Gerald Butler chilling up in space inside the space station.
Yeah, there aren't too many terribly engaging people in this. And then the people who are kind of engaging, like Ed Harris, are kind of kept at the sidelines. I think one of the reasons I think to address your comment about it being boring is I think that part of that is the conspiracy element, because it seems like this is the most well-crafted conspiracy you have ever seen, where any possible counteraction taken by the heroes has an opposite reaction. So they've already taken into account that clip we played before of Jim Sturgis talking to his colleague in Hong Kong. That guy, first of all, he manages to escape assassins coming into his office and then stealing all the records and things. He's somehow able to get on a plane, get to the United States, call his friend to come meet him so they can have a conversation about the pending geostorm. And just as he's about to meet Jim Sturgis, evil Secret Service guy is there and pushes him in front of a car. And it's like, come on, if this guy was able to make it this far... and then all of a sudden the evil conspiracy guys are able to catch up and just, you know, put a cat, and then to do it right in front of it's both smart and stupid at the same time. It's both unbelievably stupid and incredibly almost psychic levels of evil smart.
And, well, they only really even brought in that character probably just for that reason. Although it was cool because of him, we got to see the some of the Hong Kong CGI effects were pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, as cool as it could be in comparison to other parts of the film.
Yeah, but it also helped that was at night too, so it didn't have to be absolutely perfect. Because a lot of the stuff later on when it's like full geostorm, a lot of that is just looks terrible.
Awful.
The tidal wave in Abu Dhabi looked terrible. There was like tornadoes in Mumbai, and those looked terrible. And of course, they undermine like any threat of danger to those characters, because they show a little boy with a dog, and the little boy and his dog aren't gonna die.
I know, that's not needed, man. I have a dog. I love dogs. Always have, and that hurt. I was more in depth to that character and that dog than any other character in the film, or at least I felt more for that character.
But they're not gonna die. You're not gonna kill a little boy and his dog. It's as soon as you see the little boy and his dog, they'll be fine. So undermine any danger at all. There's chase sequences and things, and it's not necessary. This is, I think, a really great way this was done was The Day After Tomorrow, where it was very personal. It was about, you know, sort of it had a lot of the same themes about dealing with Mother Nature, and you can't, you know, mess with nature, and, you know, humans have to be adaptable, and humans have to realize, you know, we are fallible, and we can mess up the Earth, but the Earth will swat back.
When I first saw that,
and it was
film,
hopeful too.
I was really on it. It was my favorite film.
I believe
amazing.
It.
Amazing. Yeah.
I mean, it's not the greatest film, but it's I think it's a very enjoyable film, and I think it accomplishes what it sets out to do.
It's evidence that like disaster films or films of just a very small plot summary can still be good. Like straight up just action thriller disaster whatever films of that nature can be good. They can be enjoyable.
Yeah, I think this film, Geostorm, get rid of the conspiracy plot. It should have just been about, like, we built this satellite. It has protected us, and we've been able to go about our business, doing whatever. And we beat nature. And then it's about the system failing and how nature can adapt to whatever we think we're clever enough to come up with to countermand it. And that is a perfectly serviceable story in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly compelling. And you could add Gerard Butler telling senators to F off and whatever.
That would have been cool.
You know, it's too silly. I think the sciencey things aren't sciencey enough.
The romance. The minimal amount of romance. The one president line, though, where Jim Sturgess's girlfriend does something and the president's just like, you got to marry her.
Oh, yeah. Actually,
that was fun.
I like that sequence, though, because Abbie Cornish was – there were scenes where she's like the worst Secret Service agent in the world because she's like always leaving her post to talk to her boyfriend. And there's that scene where the guy gets run over. She like runs after the car, but you never find out later, like – Should she's a trained Secret Service agent. Shouldn't she have remembered the license plate or something that she could have followed up on that could have cracked this open a bit sooner? But then they did that sequence where they're being chased by the evil Secret Service, and they're trying to get the president to a NASA facility so that they can save the world, and she flips the car around 180. And is driving backwards as she's shooting at the evil Secret Service guys, and they go off-road and then get hit by a bolt of lightning and explode. And she is cool as ice in that sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And as, like, somebody give this woman, like, an Atomic Blonde action movie or something. Because
she hasn't been in a ridiculous amount yet, and she was okay in it.
She's a really talented actress.
Yeah, I feel bad that this was... You know, this film could have made her go bigger. It could have made her become like a main character in like a film like Atomic Blonde. But
she deserves it, though. If there's one good thing to come out of this, it's that she should get that.
I agree.
Jane Bond role.
Gonna see it. Focus on her role.
Focus on that 2 minutes where she's being a complete and utter badass.
That's great. 2 minutes. That and the bromance.
The bromance. Yeah.
Which shouldn't be funny, but it was really funny.
I love where they have like they made a very pointed remark where they're reunited for the first time after Gerard Butler is fired as the head of saving the world, and he's like, come on, bro, we used to have like our own special code and things, and he's like, that never happened. And of course later it comes in handy as they're trying to communicate over satellite with people listening in, and that was. Actually, that reminds me. There was another character I liked a lot, which is the IT girl. I think her name was Dana. I can't remember.
Yeah,
I don't know the
Dana.
Actress's name. But she was
Zazie Beeks.
Okay.
I can't read my own handwriting, but I believe it's Zazie Beeks.
Okay, but she was good. I liked her a lot, too.
She was spectacular,
She had really great comic relief.
Yeah, there wasn't, like, I thought the Hong Kong, I thought he was pretty bad, but not all the actors were terrible.
That's going to look great on the poster.
No, if they're going to do the poster, they should just focus on the bromance. You like Sturgess and Butler? Wow. You know, there's some romance here. Go see it.
Yeah. So, there were interesting things. But, you know, as we're getting closer to the end and the final sort of action sequences and the climax, I was literally saying out loud, come on, right in the middle of the movie theater. And that's not good.
No, that's not good.
You know, because I think one of the things we can get at is with these movies, we can get over thin characters, thin plots. But if you have like maybe one or two characters who you know, are interesting enough or funny enough, plus you have like a very simple plot that's very sort of character driven.
But fun.
Mm-hmm. You know, it can make up for a multitude of sins.
Mm-hmm. Make you like two main characters enough to care about them.
Right.
And then just focus on making everything else super fun.
You could have made Gerard Butler a braggart and like he's this gruff guy. But I have to believe he invented this satellite. And
I can't believe that.
I never believe at any point that he...
I feel like he stole ideas for someone else.
I think he was at the pub next to some scrawny nerd guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, what are you doing there? Oh, I'm creating a satellite system to save the world. Is that right? Whack. Now it's Gerard saving the world.
That would have actually made the film a bit more interesting.
I'd watch that movie.
There'd be that secret behind him the whole time.
But sadly, that's not the movie we got.
No.
I feel a bit bad for Dean Devlin because he you know, he wants, you know, things like Stargate. Again, these aren't perfect movies, Stargate, Independence Day, but they were very enjoyable.
And based on the CGI and like the like when those buildings are falling down, you could tell that he loved working on Independence Day and Godzilla, and he was probably a major part of the destruction parts.
Sure.
It's blowing up.
I think this probably started with the destruction, and then they're like, we need to call this something. What is it? Geostorm sounds pretty good. But I mean, this seems like, you know, something. It seems just completely like Lego filmmaking. We're going to take this brick here, this brick here, this brick here, and then we're going to build this something called Geostorm. Anyway, so see Geostorm at your own risk. It does not contain the caramel secret to saving the world from global climate change. Wish it did. But, you know, that's the way it goes. And that's the way End Credits is going to go for this week. You can follow up with this and previous episodes at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can go to Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or Twitter at End Credits Radio. Peter, where can people find you on the internets?
Mr. Towerak on Twitter or Mr. Towerak on YouTube. YouTube.
Sure about that?
Yeah.
Okay. I should talk. I'm always tripping over my own tongue. I'll be back here later today at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph, and that's with Scotty Hertz there. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more End Credits. And we will see you later.